Again, this is session 5, Buddhism in a Nutshell, our last session. For this round, anyway. How's everyone doing? Anybody come up with any questions? Is anybody new? Anybody first night here, first time here? Yeah? Hey, great. Okay. Well, great. Welcome. You picked an interesting night to come. We'll be talking about some good things tonight. I have a, so I don't forget, I'm going to go ahead and give you this, if you would like it. It's just a handout that goes over a few things that I usually talk about on the first night. It's kind of a general introduction to what this class is all about and also to Kadampa Center. So. So, let me check my cell phone, make sure it's on the proper setting, so you don't get to hear my goofy ringtone. So as usual, we're going to start with simple meditation. So, we'll get comfortable. Think about your meditation posture, which we've talked about a few times before. Back straight is an important thing. If you're sitting in a chair or sitting on a cushion, whichever you prefer. Having your back straight, supporting your body like a stack of coins or a stack of blocks. Thinking about your legs, whatever position you want them to be in. Arms, hands. Eyes, your gaze just slightly down. Eyes closed if that helps you. Eyes open slightly to let in a little bit of light if that helps you. Focus your attention on your breathing. Just breathe naturally. It's very easy when you're, especially if you haven't practiced meditation a lot, to almost force your breath. And it seems really hard to just breathe naturally. Maybe not for everybody. It certainly did for me. Like I'm really very conscious of my breathing. And not really breathing naturally. But with time, you learn to relax a little bit and just let the breath come naturally. And that can be a good experience too when you're not really feeling like you're forcing your breath or even thinking about it too much other than just resting your concentration on the natural breath. So just focus your mind on the rising and falling of your shoulders and chest as you inhale and exhale gently. Naturally. Allow your mind to settle and become calm and present, ready to engage in meditation. And create an altruistic motivation for the meditation session and for this class this evening. Think that you're meditating not just for your own individual benefit, but you're taking the time now to meditate and develop your mind to become a wiser and kinder person, able to be of benefit to all beings. focus your attention at the opening of the nostrils. Pay attention to the very subtle sensations as you breathe in and out through your nose. You can feel certain sensations as the air passes, as the small hairs move. Cooler sensations as you inhale. And warmer as you exhale. Don't follow the air into your body or out into the surrounding environment. Just place your attention on the sensations associated with the breath right at the opening of your nostrils. Your job is to keep your attention firmly placed on those sensations only. As you inhale and exhale, mentally count each inhalation and exhalation together as one. Count these from 1 to 10, concentrating on those sensations at the tip of your nose, at the opening of your nostrils. When you reach 10, begin again at 1. If you become distracted, the mind wanders to other things and moves away from the point of concentration, then begin again at 1. Gently bring your attention back to your point of concentration and begin counting again. Even if you never get past 2, it's not a problem. The point is to train your mind to focus on one point only. And this concentration can take some practice to attain. take a moment to dedicate your positive energy and insights to the well-being of all sentient beings. So we've been talking about a few different topics. Started off earlier talking about the Four Noble Truths, which is the Buddha's first teaching and kind of the core foundation for all, you know, kind of considered at the center of all Buddhist teachings. We talked about the Buddhist view of the mind, the Four Noble Truths are definitely, you know, very related to the Buddhist view of the mind. The fact that the causes of our happiness and suffering, even though they seem to us very often to be out there, the things that are happening are causing us to be happy or to suffer. It's actually our minds that are actually the causes. And these external conditions are there, these external circumstances are there, but the real causes are in our minds. And then the Buddhist view that the mind is changeable. That's just in the nature of the mind to change, and that we can direct that change and control that change to a more positive direction. We also talked about karma and rebirth, which are kind of an extension of the Buddhist view of the mind as being a continuity of consciousness with no first cause, each moment of mind being caused by a previous moment of mind. So that leads to, you know, discussions or the concepts of karma and rebirth. And these form the basis for Buddhist views about ethics, which we talked about. I think it was last week we talked about that. You know, the idea that these are, they're kind of interesting, the 10 non-virtuous actions we talked about, because they really are, you can kind of see in a very practical way how these things would be harmful, either to you or to others. It's not necessarily some just authority that's saying this is right and this is wrong. It's not the Buddha saying this is right and this is wrong. It's basically, you know, something that you can base on your own experience. We can all base our own experience. It's necessary to do that to really understand these things. And then on a little more, you know, a more advanced level, we talk about how these virtuous actions and non-virtuous actions relate to karma and rebirth, and how, you know, virtuous actions are the cause of future happiness. Non-virtuous actions are the cause of future suffering, and that this is a direct relationship. You know, it's not some cosmic scoreboard out there. I love that term, cosmic scoreboard. You can thank Venerable Tendrin for that one. Maybe she heard it somewhere else, but you know, these actions are leaving direct imprints on your mind, which influence your future experiences, your future results. We also talked about the principal aspects of the path to enlightenment, the three principal aspects of the path. And this is related to the fourth noble truth, which is the truth of the cessation of suffering, that all the suffering, all this unpleasant stuff that we experience, we do have the capability, not that it's easy, not that there's a simple recipe for it, but we do have the capability to change our minds and to end the suffering. And that there are these three principal aspects of the path to achieving that enlightenment, that end of suffering. And not just the end of suffering, but the full development of all our virtuous states of mind, the good stuff that we want to keep. So the first is renunciation. And I was trying to give kind of a comparison to smoking, in that, you know, we were talking about that last week, how, you know, when I smoked cigarettes, yes, I knew smoking was bad for me, but, you know, I really enjoyed smoking that cigarette. So all those bad things that I knew maybe could happen, they were very abstract to me, not very concrete, you know, not very real and present compared to that, you know, sensation of enjoying that cigarette. Not to mention the fact that I will totally admit I was completely addicted to nicotine, you know, and I was definitely a very strong habit. So while you're in it, you know, the thought of giving it up is really not a very pleasant thought, you know, and you certainly have to get yourself to the point where you're ready to give it up. You know, if somebody had just taken my cigarettes away and locked me in a room for 4 days and slipped food and water under the door, I probably wouldn't have been very happy. But once I reached that point, for me, and maybe some of you who've been through this too, you can understand it and relate to it. Once you reach that point where you're really ready to give it up, and you do give it up and you put it behind you, you don't miss it when you look back on it. It's not like, you know, I'm sitting here now saying, oh, it was such a wonderful thing, and I feel so terrible that I've had to give this up. it's something that you can look back on now in hindsight, in retrospect, and say, yeah, I would never really want to do that again. I'm not missing anything at all by giving this up. And so to me, that's, you know, with my very limited understanding of renunciation, that's kind of how I relate to it. That the things that you're giving up, you know, at the time when we talk about giving up, I think I read the definition, renunciation is the state of mind not having the slightest attraction to samsaric pleasures for even a second and having the strong wish for liberation. So we think about all these samsaric pleasures. This is all the stuff we like to do, right? The video games and the judge shows and the, you know, hockey and professional wrestling and, you know, food and chocolate cake, all the stuff that we like. And you think about giving that up and it seems really difficult. And that is really what we're talking about. It's giving up our craving for all these things that we look to for enjoyment. But the idea is that, you know, it's not to lock yourself in a room and or have somebody lock you in a room and keep you away from all these things until you, you know, somehow reach enlightenment that way. The idea is to follow this path that's going to get you to the place where you're ready to do that. And that's why a lot of this meditation that we do, a lot of this contemplation we do, analytical meditation, discussions, studying, it's to get us to look really closely at these things that we're currently relying on or think that give us happiness and see whether they're really and really analyze for yourself. And this is why we, you know, really take it so seriously when we talk about how you have to take the things that we're talking about here and compare them to your own experience. Because you really have to arrive at that place where you have an understanding of whether these things are benefiting you or not. You know, and Geshe-la, our, you know, resident teacher, will say, you know, if this isn't helping you, if being here isn't helping you, you shouldn't be here. Go do something else. You know, go take a nap or go watch TV or go for a walk. And he's not kidding when he says that. He's not being facetious, you know. If something else really is bringing you more happiness, then do that because that's what it's all about. It's about having a truly happy mind, thinking something good. But really what we're doing here in Buddhism in a place like this is we're really closely examining these things that we think bring us happiness and trying to determine whether really that's what we want or that's we're getting what we want out of it. So that's a little bit about you know, renunciation. The second of the three principal aspects of the path is bodhicitta. And does anybody remember what this is? Even kind of like a rough definition?
Having an altruistic attitude in everything you do?
To
achieve enlightenment for the benefit of others?
Exactly, yeah, both of those things. Yeah, very awesome. It's having the altruistic determination to achieve full enlightenment in order to free all sentient beings from suffering and bring them to enlightenment. So it's a pretty high aspiration. In this form of Buddhism, and again, there are different forms of Buddhism. This is Tibetan schools of Buddhism are all Mahayana schools. So we talk about three scopes of practice, three different scopes of practice. There would be the lower scope, which is the idea that you're accepting the idea of karma and rebirth, and you're practicing in order to prevent unfortunate rebirths. So you don't want to be born as a cow or a squirrel or a mosquito or any of the other, you know, potential unfortunate rebirths. We're looking for, you know, the best possible situation. And so you're dedicating your practice or your practice in the lower scope is focused on that. And then there's the middle scope where you're trying to free yourself completely from cyclic existence. You're not just satisfied with coming back as a human or coming back in, you know, it was considered a fortunate form, because you're still stuck in cyclic existence. You're still subject to suffering. What you're trying to do when we talk about the middle scope is completely free yourself from this cycle of uncontrolled rebirth where you're going to have to experience this suffering. And you're trying to you know, reach what we call nirvana, that state of mind where you've eliminated suffering and the causes of suffering from your mind. And so you're no longer subject to this uncontrolled cycle of rebirth. And then the highest scope of the three scopes is that's where kind of the bodhicitta relates to that. It's the idea that you're not happy with just saving yourself. You can't stand the thought of, you know, your own freedom from suffering isn't really satisfying. It's not enough when you realize all these other sentient beings are still suffering. So you're dedicating your practice to reaching a point where you can help them, where you're capable of helping them. And it's not necessarily that when we talk about these three scopes of practice, it's not that one person is only going to focus on one scope. And it's certainly not that their one is better than the other. All three scopes are an integral part of this path to enlightenment. And so some of the practices that we do are considered focused on one scope or the other, or part of one scope or the other. But certainly any particular person who's going to, you know, consider themselves a Buddhist will be focusing on different ones at different times for different purposes. You're kind of, it's like the pieces of a puzzle, not like very clear, stratified, one's better than the other, or I'm just going to do this one now. But they're all pieces of a puzzle that we're putting together to build that path. Does that make sense? Okay. So last week we did a meditation on equanimity, which I think when we talk about concepts of bodhicitta and equanimity and compassion, this particular meditation, I think just, you know, 10 or 15 minute meditation gets some points across as well as 45 minutes or an hour of discussion. So, and it's in this book, How to Meditate by Kathleen McDonald. You'll hear a lot of people here recommend this book. And the bodhicitta meditation we did is in here. It's also on the recordings. If you want to know how to get last week's recordings, let me know and I can help you find that. But if you're interested in that particular meditation. But equanimity, the Buddhist definition, is... Does anybody remember what that's all about? Kind of a description? Yeah, it's exactly. It's not seeing the normal or not basing our decisions on the normal distinctions we make between friend, enemy, and stranger. That's pretty much, you know, paraphrasing what you said. And having the desire, seeing all beings as equal, specifically seeing all beings as or one aspect of it is seeing all beings as equal in our desire to be free from suffering and to have happiness. And so basing our actions and our compassion, our desire to help others on that view of equality rather than our normal default reactions to people. And I'm going to turn everybody's favorite microphone over to you, have you kind of hang on to that for a second just in case you want to have any discussion. Like we've talked about, that's really helpful.
What's the button? Is it off ready to go?
Yeah, it's ready to go. You can just leave it on like that. So, the textbook definition of equanimity is the absence of the usual discrimination of sentient beings into friend, enemy, and stranger. And this derives from the realization that all sentient beings are equal in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. And that all sentient beings have been all things to each other since beginningless time. And this is an impartial mind that serves as the basis for the development of great love, great compassion, and bodhicitta. So bodhicitta, you know, I think in a lot of ways, and we all fall into this one way or another, our normal motivation for helping others is very often based on what they do for us. I mean, certainly, I think even if you're a very altruistic person and you do a lot of things for other people, you'd probably agree that it's a little easier to help people who are nice to you. It's a little easier to help people you like. You know, your friends, your family members, people who are appreciative of what you do. It's a little bit more difficult, you know. I mean, helping strangers, I think if you're starting to develop that altruistic motivation, it's not too difficult to you know, want to help strangers. I mean, that kind of falls into it pretty easily. But then helping people who you would view maybe as an enemy, or helping people who are just totally unappreciative, helping people who have tried to harm you or who you just don't like very much for whatever reason, that's you know, I think for anybody that becomes more difficult. And really when we talk about bodhicitta and how it's related to this concept of equanimity, bodhicitta is where you're going beyond those distinctions between friend, enemy, and stranger. And I think that's a really interesting thing about that meditation is it really gets into it. It really gives us an idea, even a small idea, of how these views of friend, enemy, and stranger, these labels that we place on people, aren't really as stuck to those people as we think they are. You know, we change all the time. Somebody who's been your best friend, all of a sudden you get in a big fight, and now you're terrible enemies. You know, somebody who is your best friend now, they were a stranger before you met them. So these things, we don't always think of them. We don't always remind ourselves that these labels change, but they really do. So equanimity is trying to go beyond those labels and viewing all people as worthy of being happy. And then having the desire to reach enlightenment yourself, to fully develop yourself so that you can help people, and you know, help sentient beings, not just people, to your greatest extent possible. Any comments about that? Questions? Thoughts? So, very much related to the idea of bodhicitta is compassion. And again, a specific definition in Buddhism, you know, we talk about compassion a lot. I'm sure people have different ideas. You know, if I asked everybody to write down a definition of compassion, I'm sure we could probably all do that. There's a very specific definition in Buddhism, which is the sincere wish that others be free from suffering and its causes. Sincere wish for freedom from suffering. And normally we do say the sincere wish that others be free from suffering and its causes, although really to experience true compassion, you have to include yourself. You have to have compassion for yourself and not leave yourself out of the, don't leave yourself off the bus, basically. So what does the word compassion bring to mind? Anybody have any just immediate thoughts that come up when we talk about compassion? Single words that come to mind? Yeah, Martha.
Kindness.
Sure, yeah. Loving kindness, that's something we talk about a lot. Yeah. Anything else that comes to mind? How about viewing compassion as weakness? Like the downside of compassion. You know, I think some people do, when you talk about compassion, maybe just in certain contexts, you know, sitting here in you know, Kanapa Center, we would think of compassion in a positive way, but certainly I think if you get into some conversations and you start talking about compassion, people might not always view it as a good thing. So does it mean letting people get away with whatever they want? You know, I would say probably not really in this context that we're talking about, but I think some people might tend to think about it that way in some contexts. You know, we think about unhealthy relationships where one person, by just, you know, unconditionally supporting the other person, is letting that other person or helping that other person, enabling that other person continue some very unhealthy behaviors. You know, there are lots of examples of that. And I think people, I would say it's probably not a totally accurate view, not in the context that we're using compassion here, but that could be sometimes what comes to mind when you talk about compassion, that people view it in that way. It's like you always have to be nice to people. You know, you can't say anything that's going to upset the other person. I mean, I think that is kind of a, you know, nobody's really, that didn't seem to really jump out at anybody immediately, but I think that certainly does come up when you talk about compassion in certain context. And it really doesn't mean that you have to let people get away. If you want people to be free from suffering, you may not necessarily let them, you know, you're not going to let them get away with whatever they want, not let them get away with doing things that are unhealthy. It doesn't mean that you can't stop somebody from doing something harmful. You can be very compassionate and yet still stop somebody from doing something harmful. And just something, you know, an example I thought of when I was going over my notes. This was a long time ago. It was probably about close to 20 years ago. I had a friend who was a photographer, was getting rid of some of his old equipment and sold it to me because he was buying new equipment. And I had an interest in doing this. This is my friend Rick that sold me this photography equipment. And another friend of ours set me up with a job doing some photography. And I was really excited about it. I thought it was, you know, a great opportunity. And my friend Rick, kind of took me aside and sat me down and gave me a little lecture about it. He wasn't really happy with me getting this job. And maybe some of it was, you know, his own want. Maybe, I don't know if he kind of was hoping to get the job himself or he would rather be doing it or, but, you know, what he said to me, he looked me straight in the eye and he said, "You're not good enough. You shouldn't be doing this. You know, you're not good enough to do this. These people are paying you good money to capture this memory for them. And you can't do enough for them. You can't do too good of a job. You know, you have to be able to go out there and produce something that's, you know, meets the requirement, that's going to meet their expectations. And you can't go and just be, you know, Joe Amateur and do this." And I went and did the job anyway, but was in my, 21 or something, and, but I did. But that conversation that he had with me, he was real direct about it. He wasn't pulling any punches. He wasn't dancing around. He didn't just keep his opinions to himself. He looked me straight in the eye and said, "You are not good enough to do this job. You don't have the experience yet." And that really made me go into that job and do a better job than I would have, and really exceed what my, step above what my capabilities were before I went into it. So certainly helpful to me, and, helpful to the people, too, that I was doing the photography for, I'm sure. So, it's just an example, maybe not a great one. Maybe you can come up with better examples, but certainly there are situations where you can be very direct with people and still be compassionate. It doesn't mean letting people get away with whatever they want. It also doesn't mean allowing yourself to be harmed. And I think when we did that equanimity meditation, there was a good paragraph in there that I want to read again. So we talk about equanimity and compassion. None of this means that we should not discriminate. On a practical level, it is necessary. Naturally, we feel closer to some people and are wise to keep our distance from others. This is not a contradiction. The point of the meditation is to develop equal concern, equal regard for everyone, whether they help or harm us at this point in time. So, trying to see if there's another line in there. But basically the idea is, it's not about allowing yourself to be harmed by any means. And there may be certain situations where you're not going to be able to help people. You can have compassion, and hopefully compassionate action is a possibility, being able to actually do something to help. But compassion is really an internal state of being, where even if you can't do anything, it's still having the desire, the wish for that person to be free from suffering, and the intention, the wish that you could do something. So, and something that certainly an experience I had, I mean, there were some real practical benefits to this too. And I think about driving, definitely when I was younger, I was not a very compassionate driver when I was younger. I wouldn't say I was, ever gave into total road rage, but I certainly used my horn quite a bit and, gave certain gestures that were not the standard turn signals. And it's the typical stuff that we get mad at, right? Somebody driving too slow in front of you, or somebody cutting you off, somebody doing something really dangerous, right? The person that cuts right in front of you, you got to slam on your brakes. And I used to get really mad at those kind of things. And I almost remember the day where I was driving and I was going somewhere, I think it was like reading directions off a piece of paper in this neighborhood, trying to figure, I'd never been there before, didn't know where I was going. And somebody was behind me, like driving right up on my bumper. And my initial reaction was to get a little upset about it. But then I realized, how many times have I been driving behind somebody and gotten angry at them because they were driving so slow? And maybe that person was doing exactly what I'm doing at the time, is, reading directions. They're looking for an address. They're not sure where they're going. Perfectly legitimate reason why they're driving slower than I want them to drive. Has nothing to do with me, right? We always think it has to do with me. This person is obviously just there in front of me to ruin my day. But then you start seeing it from the other side that, oh yeah, maybe that's why that person's driving slow. Same thing with the guy that cuts you off, the person that does that really, dangerous, terrible thing. You can't imagine why they just did that. And I certainly had those experiences until one day, I did something and realized that I was really glad the other driver was paying attention and that we weren't all wrapped up on the side of the road in a big wreck, because certainly my actions, I just tried my best to make that happen, realizing I had just really made a serious effort, ignorantly, right, not trying to, but, what I just did was extremely dangerous, could have caused an accident. The only reason it didn't is because the other person did the right thing. And then, you have those kind of experiences and you start saying, oh yeah, and the next time somebody does that, maybe you don't remember it right away. But maybe that can lead to the idea that, for your own benefit, for your own peace of mind, when somebody cuts you off, when somebody's driving really, really, slowly in front of you, for your own peace of mind, your own benefit, that it doesn't upset you so much. You know, you were talking, you gave the great example of the flat tire, you know. But certainly actions of other people can get us really fired up and really disturb our peace of mind. But then when you start seeing it from the other side and seeing that, you know, you've done the same thing, that's part of developing a compassionate attitude, I think. And there can be, have some really practical benefits. Because certainly all the yelling and screaming and horn honking and gestures and everything probably doesn't help other people become better drivers, you know. I mean, there may be things that do, but probably in the grand scheme of things, if it does help in any way, it's probably a very limited use. So if nothing else, you know, helping to maintain a better, calmer state of mind for yourself, it's just to your benefit and certainly not harming the other person. So you'll hear, one of the terms you may have heard, is a bodhisattva. People have probably heard that term. So when we talk about this path to enlightenment, you know, you kind of look at where we are now, just where I am, just an ordinary being, you know, trying to get through every day without messing things up too badly, to the idea of being a Buddha, where you fully, fully developed your mind, cleared away all these obscurations, all these negative states of mind, fully developed all positive states of mind. Well, there are different stages to getting there. And a bodhisattva is a being who's reached a stage of accomplishment to where bodhicitta, this altruistic desire to reach enlightenment, to benefit other beings, arises spontaneously, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. All their thoughts, all their actions are guided by that altruistic intention. So, you know, this is somebody who would never react out of ego, out of selfishness to a situation. They would always react to every situation with the desire to help others. You know, I think there's even a story saying that, you know, if a hungry wolf came up and bit off a bodhisattva's hand, the bodhisattva would try to cut off their other hand to give the wolf too, because obviously the wolf is hungry, you know, or to feed the wolf's children, you know, things like that. Pretty amazing when you think about, you know, I mean, put it in those kind of terms, but it is the idea that there are stages along this path to enlightenment. And if you can kind of picture, you know, imagine, whether you're totally convinced it's possible or not, imagine the idea of a Buddha fully developing all these qualities. Then this, a bodhisattva is, you know, it's not like you wake up one morning and all of a sudden you're a Buddha. There are stages along the way. So a bodhisattva is someone who has, through great effort, through tremendous effort, and taking these steps along the path, reached that stage. What they say is that a bodhisattva has not totally eliminated all obscurations from their mind. They haven't totally eliminated all obscurations. They haven't achieved full enlightenment, but they're certainly well along the way. So if you hear that term. Sometimes they're used interchangeably, like Tara, green Tara, the tanka we have up here. She's considered, these are all Tara statues on the altar. So Tara is considered the bodhisattva of compassionate action. That's green Tara. So not just having the wish for others to be from suffering, but actually taking action to free others from suffering. But also you'll hear Tara called the Buddha of compassionate action. So I'm not really sure how technically those terms are used interchangeably, but sometimes they are. Any questions about that? Comments? So bodhicitta, again, we've talked about these three principal aspects of the path to enlightenment, renunciation being one, bodhicitta being another, and the third is the wisdom of emptiness. And this is a really interesting topic. One of the things you may hear people say is that, so bodhicitta is one of the two wings to enlightenment. It's kind of a nice metaphor. They say just like a bird needs two wings to fly, there are two wings to enlightenment, two things that are required to reach enlightenment, which are compassion and then wisdom. So even His Holiness the Dalai Lama has said that, you know, compassion by itself isn't enough. You need to have the wisdom to really be able to benefit sentient beings. You need to have the wisdom to know how to do that in the most effective way. That's one of the reasons why, you know, a bodhisattva, very, very incredibly compassionate being, but they're still striving to reach full enlightenment, because only when you reach full enlightenment, when you eliminate all those obscurations from knowing, that's when you have the ability to know the best way in all circumstances to help others. So what is an emptiness? Emptiness is a very interesting topic. You'll hear people talk about it as a very difficult topic. And, I mean, hopefully that's not discouraging. It's like other things we've discussed. It's not simple. It's not like this is how you connect your iPhone to your Gmail account. You know, go here and click on this icon and go to this menu and turn this on. You know, it's not that simple. We like things that are that. I like things that are that simple. I'm sure a lot of other people do too. And this isn't one of those things. Because I'm a geek and I like stuff like that. Yeah. If we were having a class on that, I could demonstrate the steps very easily, and with an hour and a half's worth of time, you would probably be able to repeat them. But emptiness is not like that. So it's an English word. Also keep in mind as we talk about this, emptiness is an English word. We're using it to describe a certain phenomena, but it's also a word that we use in our everyday language. So like other things we've talked about, it can be kind of helpful to set aside any pre-existing connotations, because you can start going down that path of, well, why is it empty? What is empty? And if you're basing it on the, you know, everyday definition, that might not be exactly what we're talking about. So what is emptiness? Emptiness is defined as the absence of inherent existence. And inherent existence is also called intrinsic reality, concrete independent existence, existing from its own side. There's some other interesting terms too, like suchness, which are even a little bit, doesn't help me as much. But so this idea of inherent existence is a quality that we instinctively project on ourselves and everything we experience. And it's a belief that things exist from their own side, independent of parts, causes, and conditions, and our own minds experiencing those things, those phenomena. So this is one of the reasons why, to me, emptiness is so interesting, really, really interesting, but also kind of difficult to get your head around, because what we're talking about is our actual experience of reality. And the fact that our experience of reality is not completely accurate. In fact, we'd say it's very inaccurate. The way we normally instinctively view things as existing isn't exactly how they exist. So we're getting into some really, really heavy stuff here that you have to kind of unwrap and unravel. And an example that I think, maybe is helpful. I mean, we'll talk about a couple examples, and hopefully one or some of them are going to be helpful. But so if I say the word ibu. Ibu. So, I mean, maybe it doesn't mean anything to you, or maybe it, is that a bird or just a nonsense word? Probably maybe doesn't have any meaning to anybody here. Now, if I say mother, that word probably brings up, immediately certain feelings, certain thoughts, certain emotions. Maybe you had a very good relationship with your mother and you have, warm feelings. Some of us have, not so good relationships with our parents, and so there are other feelings. But there are certainly very strong feelings, images, connotations that, that come up when you say the word mother. Now, the word ibu, that nonsense word, is actually in Indonesian, a dialect that's spoken in Indonesia. Ibu means mother. Right? So now if I say ibu, all of a sudden, very different connotations, right? All of a sudden, it's a very different feeling. Maybe you're even picturing this woman in Indonesia holding a small child, very nice image. So now here's the thing. If words, when we just go around every day talking and thinking that our words have these specific meanings and everybody understands them, and the words themselves possess those meanings. But if words inherently possess these meanings, these qualities that we assign to them, then the minute I said ibu, everybody in the room would have said, oh yeah, mother, right? You would have had initially that same response. Just like, if somebody walked in the room who just came over from Indonesia, really didn't speak any English, and I showed them a picture and I said, oh, this is my mother. Well, they would look at that and look at you, kind of no reaction. You said ibu. They would go, oh, ibu, oh, mother, ibu, right? They make the connection. So if these words that we use, even the English words that we take for granted, if they, those words had any intrinsic meaning, inherent existence, from their own side had those meaning, then everybody in the world would understand them when you spoke that word. Right? You can kind of, it's a little bit of an out there concept, but I think maybe, you know, hopefully you can kind of get the idea. So the idea is, you know, ibu, a word is just, well, what is it? It's a collection of sounds, right? I mean, technically you could say it's a collection of frequencies, of sound waves, right? Or syllables. You could look at it as syllables, you know, if you wanted to, letters. And why does it exist? Well, it exists because of causes and conditions, right? Because that word ibu exists to have that meaning because somewhere along the line in Indonesia, people started using that word somehow for some reason to represent that idea. And I happen to know somebody who lived in Indonesia whose husband is from there and lived there for a long time, and that's where I learned the word. That's how the word got here into our room tonight. And so that word, the meaning, that word as it exists for you now, also exists because of your mind perceiving it that way. There's probably a distinct difference between the way your mind perceives that word and the way you perceived it when I first said it. So your mind certainly has a role in how that word exists to you now. Okay? A little bit out there stuff, but, you know, hopefully we're you know, it's making sense. So the idea when we talk about emptiness is that really we could draw this comparison to everything we experience. We perceive things as having a independent, inherent existence. That things exist from their own side. That the way we perceive things, that is a cushion because the quality of being a cushion is inherent in that object, right? That the car, that brand new car that you just bought, that you love, that is the joy of your life now, all those good qualities are coming from the car. Everything that you associate with that car is coming from the car. And we associate, we perceive, you know, I mean, we don't really think about it this way, but when you really start thinking about it, this is the way we do perceive things, including ourselves. We perceive ourselves as having this independent, inherent existence. When actually, things are dependent. They're dependent on their parts, on causes and conditions, and on what we call a labeling consciousness, or a designating consciousness, a mind experiencing those things. So, you know, a car is also, you know, a good example. You look at a car and you see a solid, independent car, this thing that's there, and you look at it and you say, it's a car. And it seems like all this, what's causing you to identify that object as a car is coming from its own side. So a little exercise, a little mental exercise is you say, you know, where is the car? Where is it? So you would point at the car, right? But you're actually pointing to a spot on the car. So let's consider exactly what you're pointing at. You're pointing at maybe the bumper or the fender or the door or the windshield. Is that particular spot itself the car? So is the concept of a car contained in any of those particular spots? So when does a car start to become a car? How many of those parts do you have to put together before you could actually say it's a car? How many parts could you take away before it's no longer a car? So, you know, that label car starts, you start thinking about things in this way, and then, you know, it challenges that just automatic assumption that we have. That, you know, that's a car. So how does a car really exist? What we say in Buddhism is that things are interdependent and changing from moment to moment. So it's not necessarily what we see. It gets really interesting because there have been a lot of conferences, the Mind and Life conferences. I don't know if you've heard of those, but there have been a lot in recent years, last couple of decades, a lot of discussions between physicists and Buddhist monks. Psychologists, neurologists, and Buddhist monks. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is promoting this Mind and Life Institute, where a lot of these facilitating a lot of these conferences, because the way that physicists, and I'm not really an expert in this, I have kind of an amateur interest in it, but the way that physicists are telling us now that things exist is starting to fit more and more. It's not like all the physicists are going to suddenly shave their heads and put on robes and start, you know, becoming monks and ignore all their training. But there's certain parallel ideas between the way modern physics is describing the universe and reality and the way that Buddhism has been describing it for all this time. And especially this idea of things not being as solid and existing and independent as we perceive them. You know, most of what we see there is actually empty space. Most of what you're looking at is empty space. All these particles that are changing from moment to moment. So, you know, if we look at ourselves, well, how do we actually exist? And this is where it really starts to get interesting. So, you know, we consist of a body, right? So you have flesh, blood, organs, cells, all these physical entities. And you have a mind, right? That certainly exists. You have thoughts, you have feelings, you have experiences, you have other mental activity. All these things exist. So those things are there, right? And this is a really important concept. When we talk about emptiness, we're not saying that nothing exists. Things do exist. You do have a body, a physical form. You do have a mind, this continuity of consciousness, these thoughts, these feelings, these experiences. But on top of that, we place these labels, right? Labels like man or woman or American or your name, whatever it is, Scott. So these ideas, these things that we tend to look at as what we are and who we are on a normal, everyday, instinctive basis are actually more reflections of those labels. And we especially have this idea, you know, in our ego, this is just kind of a quote from the Buddhism in a Nutshell course, our ego grasps on to a fantasized stability and permanence of these labels. So we don't necessarily see ourselves as constantly changing all the time. We tend to like the idea of things being rather fixed and permanent. Certain ideas, that's why certain ideas are certainly very appealing, like about if you think of reincarnation in terms of you just being reborn into another body. That's kind of nice to think about. You know, yeah, I'm going to come back around and have all my thoughts and my feelings and still know all my jokes and still have my good tennis serve. The idea of a soul, you know, if that's what you believe in. But what we would say in Buddhism is that idea of permanence, that's something that you, as you perceive yourself now going on and on and lasting, that's actually an illusion. It's invented. This idea of a permanent and independent self is something that we've invented or that we invent on an ongoing basis. And it's actually a hallucination. And think again about that equanimity meditation that we did. These labels, it's kind of maybe a little easier to see it when we look at others, these labels we place on others. I mean, think about somebody that really, really just drives you nuts, that knows exactly how to push your buttons. That person, that label of enemy, or whatever lovely term you have for that person, you know, I mean, it really sticks to that person. We really think of those qualities we don't like as coming from that person. And the same thing with friend, the people you like, the person who just did something really, really nice for you this past weekend that you really liked. Really, those good qualities, those wonderful qualities we see as coming from that person. But then you do something like this meditation that we did where we really challenge those ideas and talk and you know, really examine the way that these labels change all the time. And you start to get this little bit of an idea that they are labels that we're placing on things, rather than qualities that are coming from those things themselves. Yes?
Use the mic. I just want to give what I'm going to ask if this kind of fits. So this is a really corny example. So you know how Monopoly just picked its latest piece, right?
The cat, you know about that? The cat. Is that what we're
right.
talking about? Yeah.
And it was cracking me up because people were very passionate, right? The iron, who'd want the iron? It doesn't go fast. You want something with wheels when you're on Monopoly and you're trying to get to the board, you know,
yes,
to the board and win, right? And anyway, so it's just kind of cracking me up because, you know, the cat won. And of course, then the people who are like, oh, good, the cat won. They're so sweet and warm and cuddly and playful. And they have all their labels that they mm-hmm. associate with cats that are all warm and fuzzy and mm-hmm. wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have people who don't care for cats,
mm-hmm.
who really were rooting for something else, and they're like, oh, God, a cat? Mm-hmm. You know, geez, blah, you know, whatever the negative, I can't mm-hmm. imagine what they could be. But anyway, negative connotations mm-hmm. connected to a cat. But essentially, you know, you had this little piece, this little game piece, and people layer all these associations
mm-hmm.
on it, you mm-hmm. know? So it's not just a little game piece. There's all this emotional involvement.
Right.
And it seems like that's kind of what you're saying in some ways, is that you have this object or a person or what have you, and our perception of that person is so colored by all the labels that we put on that
mm-hmm.
object or person?
Yes.
Is
and we don't
of?
See, and the big hallucination is that we don't see ourselves placing those labels on that object. So we see those qualities as coming from that object. Yeah. And just, you know, keep on, like, this class is Buddhism in a nutshell, and this is definitely emptiness in a nutshell, because we're only getting a little bit of an introduction to this. We're not going to unravel this all tonight. Hopefully give you some food for thought. I think it would be great if you wake up tomorrow and go, that's kind of interesting, and I wonder how, yeah, and the Monopoly piece, of course, you know, and you start rolling this around in your mind a little bit. But, yeah, you know, there are certainly examples that come up that you know, maybe illustrate in different ways. But it's a complex – one of the things they say is you can actually only fully understand – well, you can only fully understand karma once you're fully enlightened. And when you actually fully understand, when you have a direct perception of emptiness, a direct experience of emptiness, that is actually what cuts the delusions and frees you from cyclic existence. That is actually what cuts the root, that this ignorance that we have is actually the root of all, and we'll get into that a little bit, the idea about this, but it's actually the root of all other suffering. So it's a pretty big chunk that we're taking on. Yeah.
So if things don't have their own meaning, right? Basically, like things that we give things meaning, is that part of it?
To some extent, yeah.
So is the idea of emptiness, is that related to where does the meaning come? Like, religions talk about, like, what, you know, right, and everyone's looking for, like, what is life's meaning?
Mm-hmm.
So is there an aspect to which it is, like, there is, you know, when you start to peel off the layers of things looking for what is essential or what is the meaning, that there is nothing there, that are all of our, that, like, all of our experiences of life, that they are subjective, and that the meaning that we give to our lives is that exactly that, is that we provide that meaning, and they're not. There's nothing that is there separate from it, or
so. There, things do exist, and this is one of the things that we tend to do, is we tend to go to extremes. And I'm not sure if this is where you know this could be where you're going with it, or all I'm going to say is that you have to be careful not to go here to the idea that nothing exists, that everything is purely subjective. Right. So, and this is one of the things that usually when people talk about emptiness, you'll hear them get into this discussion, that we tend to bounce back and forth between these two extremes. One extreme would be that everything has this concrete existence coming from its own side. The other extreme would be, as soon as we start to try to let go of that, then we bounce over to the other side, which is everything's just totally, you know, nothing actually exists. And what we're looking for is something in the middle. Right, things do exist, and they exist in dependence on their parts, their causes and conditions, and that labeling consciousness. So this is how things exist, and you know it gets to be kind of an interesting. And there, you know, I think even some analytical meditations where you do that, you know, you analyze something and you analyze these aspects of something, and what else is there? What else is there that doesn't fit into one of those categories? So when we talk about emptiness, again, when we use that term emptiness, you have to realize that it's what we're saying it's empty of, and that it's empty of that tangible, immediate quality that we immediately, instinctively associate with these things. They do exist. They do have meaning. They do exist, but not in the way that we instinctively, automatically perceive them. So that might, to get more into like the meaning and the, kind of some of the things you were getting into, that probably takes a little bit more contemplation to unravel that. But hopefully, does that help a little bit? Okay. The big thing is to avoid going too far into it and saying, oh, nothing exists then. Everything is just an illusion. Well, things do exist, but it's that wrapper that we're putting on top of it that's an illusion. So we'll keep going. Anybody else, any other comments right now, questions? Or okay. We'll kind of keep going with it to see, you know, some of the implications. What they say is all of our interactions. So this is an interesting idea that all of our, and it kind of makes sense if you're kind of, you know, going along with it up to this point, or at least entertaining these ideas, that all our interactions with reality are tainted by our belief in this hallucination, in this independent inherent existence. So we have this image of ourself, right? That I exist as I perceive myself, that this Scott, this person with these memories, with these thoughts, with these feelings, that likes this kind of ice cream and doesn't like that kind of ice cream, and all these qualities that I have, good and bad. We have this idea of it as being very fixed and very permanent. This sense of I. Somebody, one of the ladies that was sitting in the back of the class was talking about ego a couple weeks ago. And when we talk about ego in Buddhism, it has a very specific meaning. When we talk about ego or I, it is this sense of an independent, inherent existence. So this sense of ourselves as being independently inherently existing. And so when someone or something enhances this image we have of ourselves, then we're attracted to that person or that thing. When someone or something harms or undermines this image we have of ourselves, then we feel aversion towards that person or that thing. And so this attachment and aversion that we talk about are born from this fundamental ignorance of how things exist, this belief in a permanent self. And then all the other non-virtuous states of mind evolve from that attachment and that aversion. So when we say that this ignorance is the root cause of our suffering, this is basically what we're talking about. It's how this ignorance, this belief in an independent, inherent self, creates this causes us to react and interact with other people and other things out of attachment, out of aversion, based on how it affects our image of ourselves. And then from that, these other non-virtuous states of mind grow out of it. So somebody does something nice for me, that reinforces this idea that, you know, I, of course, am a nice person and people should be doing nice things for me. And then I like that person more because of what they do for me, and I want them to do more good things for me. Somebody does something to me that's not nice, that, you know, it's that. And that's one of the things that it's an interesting exercise you hear people talk about, is when somebody does something that's harmful, that sense of yourself that arises. I mean, I heard somebody talk about it one time, which I think is a great exercise, is think about when you're accused of doing something that you didn't do. Coworker, friend, family member, partner, spouse, whoever accuses you of doing something that you know you didn't do, and you're being wrongly accused of that. That sense of yourself, of who is being wrongly accused, that rises up. You almost feel it in your throat. That's the self that doesn't exist. That's the self that gets us into trouble. The I that doesn't exist. So to overcome these non-virtuous mental states, we have to overcome that ignorance. And that's one of the reasons why we're so interested in this juicy topic of emptiness. Because this actually fully understanding a direct perception of this, when we really get it, when the light bulb comes on, that's what actually cuts the root cause of our suffering. So they say. So, you know, when we talk about how things do exist, a car does exist in a conventional way. There are parts that have come together, that have been assembled. There are causes and conditions. So the engineer, you know, that designed this particular car, Henry Ford, the guy who developed the production techniques and popularized the car and made it so everybody could have one. All the causes, everything that's come together, the karma for you to be born a human and be able to perceive this object as a car. All these causes and conditions come together. And these parts of the car establish a base. This base is not a car. It's not what we perceive as a car. It's just a particular structure that we label. We label as a car. And we label these things in a certain way because of our karma. This is how karma, remember we said the karma isn't just the big things. It's not just when you get a flat tire or win the lottery. Everything is affected by karma. Everything is a result of karma. Even how you perceive things, the reason that you perceive things in a certain way is because you have the karma to perceive them in a certain way. That's why you perceive that car as a mode of transportation, as a vehicle. The ants, when you leave that bag of cookies in your back seat, perceive the car as their new home, right? They don't know that it's going to roll around and go somewhere. So it's your karma that causes you to perceive things in that certain way. Our ignorance of how things actually exist causes us to merge our perception with our experience of the base that is there, this conventional the base that is there. So we can't separate the two things. You know, very kind of intellectually, maybe we can start to see this, but on a very fundamental experiential level, we say that we're not able to separate our experience of this base with our perception of what it is, that these things are so intertwined that we can't separate them. And so we act accordingly. We become attached, right? My car that I love, my little RAV4 out there that I love driving around in, that's so fun, right? All those good things that I feel about it, I never want to let it go. Not just that it's just an object out there that I'm labeling all these things on, that I'm piling all these qualities on. But on a very fundamental level, we talk about it and kind of get our heads around it, but we do this on a very fundamental level that we can't even really get our heads around and perceive. That's what all the meditation's about and the study's about and the hours and hours and hours we spend doing all this stuff is to try to actually get to that point where we can perceive these things. So, and again, an important thing to remember is if that perceived, permanent, self-existing car really existed, then everyone would experience it the same way. All beings would experience it the same way. And this is kind of an interesting exercise to get the idea of how things do exist. If things really did exist from their own side, permanent, self-existent, then they wouldn't exist the way we perceive them. Everybody would perceive everything the same way. Everybody would recognize, just like you do, that one flavor of ice cream is the best, right? And all others are just inferior, right? And things wouldn't exist. We wouldn't be able to interact with things the way we do if they had this permanent self-existing from their own side. You know, enemies wouldn't become friends. Friends wouldn't become enemies. Strangers wouldn't become friends. Everything would just be fixed. Physicists would be having a fit. So ultimately, when you really get your head around this, you realize there is no car there. That label that we're placing on it, the label doesn't exist. This perception of a car that we base all of our interactions on doesn't exist. And not finding that, negating that, the existence of that, is the emptiness of the car. That's what it is empty of. And the same thing for ourselves. You know, Venerable Rubina, you probably heard me talk about, you'll hear people around here talk a lot about Venerable Rubina. She was here just a couple months ago. She has a great analogy when she's talking about all these, you know, states of mind that we're trying to get under control, the good ones and the bad ones, right? So we have these loud, noisy, crazy roommates that are anger and jealousy and aggression, and they're kind of running the show more often than we want them to. And then we have the calm, peaceful roommates, and they, you know, spend a lot of time just in the background hanging out. And what we're really trying to do is get them more engaged. Patience, loving kindness, all those good things, generosity, all those positive qualities, you know. So we can picture all these qualities that we have as these roommates all living together in our minds. And those things do exist. Those thoughts, those states of mind, all those things do exist. There's just no landlord, right? The I, the self that we perceive as running the whole show, is that really there? That's what we're challenging. Is that really there? Is that self really there? So we do exist. Everything we experience is, we call it, when we talk about the way things do experience, we talk about them as being dependent arising. And this is what I mentioned earlier about having the parts, existing independent on parts, existing independent on causes and conditions, existing independence on that designating consciousness, that mind experiencing that thing, that moment of mind experiencing that thing. So any questions, comments? Pretty heavy stuff. It's one of my favorite topics. I don't know how well I explain it, but it really does get interesting. I was certainly a little, you know, intimidated in the beginning when, like, I went to, it was Robbie Watkins, I think, the class, the Discovering Buddhism class on emptiness, and even a couple other classes. It's the first thing everybody always says is this is a really hard topic, you know, and they're not kidding. You know, it is very challenging to understand, very difficult to understand, but hopefully that doesn't discourage anybody from exploring it, because it really does start to get interesting. When you start challenging all these automatic assumptions that we make, all these preconceived notions we have about how things exist.
How does that liberate you from samsara?
So samsara, how does that liberate you from samsara? Go ahead if you have more.
How does emptiness liberate you, or does it liberate you?
The idea is that, and again, I can only explain this to the best of my ability based on how it's been explained to me, which may not be ideal, but we remain in cyclic existence because of attachment and aversion. And we remain in this cycle of uncontrolled rebirth, experiencing suffering because of karma, because of negative karma. And attachment and aversion are reactions caused by that fundamental ignorance, that belief in the independent inherent self. So once you can, and I guess I think maybe this is an example somebody used, but it's like the first time you see a magic trick. I mean, imagine you're a kid and you see this wonderful, awesome magic trick, and you're amazed at how this person suddenly made this, you know, 12-foot bunny rabbit appear on stage. But then you learn how the trick was done, and you never see it the same way again. You understand what's really going on and where all the strings are in the mirrors and everything. So it's the same thing. We're operating. What we're seeing is the magic trick. What we're seeing is the illusion. And all of our reactions are based on that. And what we're going for in this understanding of emptiness is to understand the actual mechanics of the trick and why that 12-foot rabbit actually appeared on stage and what it actually is. Is it a projection? Is it a animatronic thing? So once you understand that, then you'll never see it the same way again. I don't know if that's a good, helpful or not, but you know, as far as the actual mechanics of it, how does it actually work? Like, what actually happens when you get this perception of emptiness, and how does that cut, you know, attachment and aversion? I don't know. Describing it in any more detail than that is beyond my understanding. Yeah.
I'm satisfied.
But that they are connected. You know, they're connected. You start. I think the more you think about it, the more you do start to see how they're connected.
I'm trying to figure out how to make this make sense. So does this only work with physical things and not relationships and emotions and things like that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so are you asking, are only physical things empty of inherent?
Yes.
Everything is empty of inherent.
So even like a relationship or...
Thoughts. Feelings, perceptions, everything is empty of inherent existence. A Buddha is empty of inherent existence. Enlightenment is empty of inherent existence. Everything is empty of inherent existence. Everything exists in dependence on other things. That's the other way to look at it, right? You have to go from one to the other to keep the picture in mind. Everything exists in dependence on parts, on causes and conditions, and on a designating consciousness.
Okay, so can you give me an example? I understand the tangible goods.
Yeah.
But could you give me an example, like with the relationship, how that would work with relating to causes and
so things. Your perception of the person that you're in a relationship with, your thoughts about that person, your feelings about that person. It's really interesting if you get a chance to do this. Do you have this book, How to Meditate?
I do.
Okay. If you do the equanimity meditation, and it's or just read through it, you know, sit and do the meditation. It's chapter 8.
Okay.
And we just did that last week. That I think gives you kind of an idea of how our thoughts towards others are dependent, are labels, how we perceive the way other people are, especially people we really feel strongly attached to or strong aversion to, we really perceive those characteristics as coming to them, from their side. But what the meditation does is take you through this whole process of saying, is it really a characteristic that's coming from that person? You know, so when you see someone else as generous,
mm-hmm.
is that really a characteristic that's coming from that person, that's intrinsic, inherent in that person? Or is it dependent on your perception of it? Is it dependent on causes and conditions?
Would that also go with happiness, sadness, everything? Okay,
everything.
I got it.
Yep, everything. I mean, it's a good question. Well, how far does this go? You know, what are we talking about here? Are we just talking about this? Or is it really everything?
Yeah.
And yeah, it is. Everything is lacks inherent existence.
Okay. You know? So I can see how it relates to... I'm sorry, guys.
No, it's okay.
So I've watched a lot of the documentaries on physics and stuff, so mm-hmm. I definitely get the whole everything's made up of parts and,
mm-hmm.
and how we see things come from. I think they even said it was like your memory of what you used to think for, so mm-hmm. that's a cushion, but your memory of what you've done in the past with the cushion also makes it a cushion.
Mm-hmm.
I get all that.
Yeah.
But, okay, I got
it. So that's good if you get it. And I think some things are easier to get than others. I think some aspects of this might click with you a little more quickly than others. And what might be helpful is to try to use the part you get.
Yeah.
Spend a little more time with that part that you get and try to see how it relates to the parts that are a little bit harder to digest. And again, it's like we talked about earlier, when we're talking about these things, you do have to kind of go back to the definitions
mm-hmm.
and make sure that you're not getting too far away. If you're trying to understand the Buddhist view on things, make sure you're not getting too far away from the actual Buddhist definitions. You know, maybe go back and, like, there's articles online about this, some good books about it. You know, Lama Zopa Rinpoche has, How Things Exist, The Essence of the Heart Sutra. From His Holiness the Dalai Lama. That's about this topic, basically. So you can kind of go back and read those things and get kind of recharge your batteries in terms of what the actual Buddhist definitions are, and then go back again and look at your analogy. I think you do have to kind of go back and forth between those things. And then also, again, like we talked about, it's also helpful to look at this in the bigger context, you know, of why are we doing this? Why are we trying to understand this? So that we can be better capable of helping ourselves and helping others and being a benefit to others. So again, those are two things that I mentioned earlier that I think are really helpful as you try to wrestle with these ideas. Is everyone's, you know, you do have to compare it to your own experience. That's such an essential and key part of Buddhism, is comparing these things to your own experience, getting your experiential understanding of these things. But also, every once in a while, going back and checking with the texts and making sure that you're not getting too far. If you're trying to understand it in the Buddhist sense, make sure you haven't kind of lost that foundation in the Buddhist definitions. And then again, looking at it, how does this relate to the whole picture? Right. What else? Comments? Questions? Okay. Yes.
I understand there have been many Buddhas.
Mm-hmm.
If a Buddha is able to free all beings, mm-hmm. why are we still enslaved?
A Buddha is able to know best how to help sentient beings. So by having removed all these obstacles to knowing, a Buddha knows how best to help. But we still have to do the work. We still have to do the work. And we still have to do the work step by step. So I think one of the best, you know, relating to that concept, one of the best things I've heard, very simple, all a Buddha can do is teach. So they do say that Buddhas can manifest in many different ways, many different forms. That person that you got into a big argument with at work today, something that really helps you deal with those situations is to think, this person could be a Buddha who's here to teach me something, who's here to help me practice patience. I've gotten through some days using that one. But that's all that a Buddha can do. And we have to, based on our own minds and at whatever pace we're ready to at the current time, work through this step by step. So we do say that Buddhas are omniscient, that once you remove these obstacles to knowing and connect to that very subtle level of consciousness, your mind is connected to everything and you can know. But Buddhas are not omnipotent, so they cannot control us. They can't grab us, I wish, it would be great. They can grab you by the back of the neck and drag you to enlightenment. I would volunteer for that, but they can't. They can't. They just, you know, we have to do the work. We have to follow the path. They can show us, you know, where the path is and describe it every way possible, but we have to get there. You know, it's like teaching a kid math, teaching anything. I mean, if you've ever had any experience teaching anybody, you would love to just open the head up and pour all the information in there. But you have to. And that's one of the reasons why we're so grateful to Buddhas, to teachers, because they're so patient. Because they're going to keep repeating things over and over and over again until we get it. And sometimes that's what they have to do. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Good question. Very good question. So just to kind of wrap things up, so what is a Buddhist? What does it mean to be a Buddhist? I think that's kind of a nice note to end on. So being a Buddhist doesn't mean, you know, memorizing texts, sitting on a cushion, reciting mantras. It's not the external manifestations. These are all just things that we do to help us get where we're going. One of the descriptions of a Buddhist is an internal being. So it's the idea that rather than focusing all your attention on what's going on in the outside world, which we very easily do, you're starting to focus your attention on the internal processes and how they're affecting your experience. There is an external ceremony. You know, so technically to become a Buddhist, there's a ceremony called a refuge ceremony. Just like in other spiritual practices, there are specific ceremonies when you decide that you're going to, you know, practice that or embrace that particular practice. So there's a ceremony called a refuge ceremony in Buddhism where basically you decide that you are going, we talk about the triple gem or the three objects of refuge, which are the Buddha, the teacher, the Dharma, which are the teachings, and then the Sangha, the community of spiritual practitioners. There's also Buddha, those are on a conventional level. There's the ultimate Buddha, which is the enlightened mind, the ultimate Dharma, which are the realizations in the minds of enlightened beings, and then the ultimate Sangha, which are the full community of enlightened beings. And so you basically what refuge is, the reason it's called refuge is because you're choosing to look to those for refuge instead of all the other things that we look for, like, you know, a nice quiet night playing on the Xbox, or, you know, a bottle of wine or whatever it is we normally look to, relationships, you know, all the things that we look to that are impermanent and ultimately aren't always there when we need them or aren't always going to do the job when we need them to. We talk about four seals in Buddhism, which is kind of a little bit of a review, four basic tenets that define Buddhism. All compositional phenomena are impermanent. So understanding that things are constantly changing, they aren't solid and fixed as we like to perceive them, but they are constantly changing and permanent, changing from moment to moment. You're not surprised when the car breaks. You're not surprised when your wonderful partner comes home and has had a bad day and yells at you as soon as they walk through the door. Things change. And they get better, too. They get better again, too. You know, you take the car to the mechanic and it gets fixed. Your wonderful partner has a glass of wine and comes back and apologizes for yelling at you. All contaminated phenomena are by nature suffering. All phenomena are empty of self-existence, what we've just talked about. Nirvana is true peace. That's what we're seeking. We're seeking not just these temporary distractions, but nirvana, this permanent cessation of suffering and its causes. I think another important aspect of being a Buddhist is we haven't talked about it a lot. There's so many things in this class, you know, that would be great to talk about, that would be great to include in a Buddhism in a nutshell class, but we just don't have time to talk about everything. But one of the things we didn't get into a lot of discussion about is a precious human rebirth, and that concept that this form that you're in right now, that we're sitting in this class, you're so fortunate to have it. Strictly by the Buddhist definition, the reason you're a human now is because of lifetimes and lifetimes of ethical behavior, of strong ethics, virtuous action that's resulted in this form. Being here and having the freedom and the ability and the opportunity to practice, to learn, to improve your mind. And so, you know, in a more generic sense, the idea of don't take things for granted. You know, appreciate what you have. You know, it's a great saying. I don't know if this is strictly a Buddhist saying, but I've heard it mentioned in you know, classes or read it in books. But a wealthy person isn't the one who has the most, but the one who needs the least. So, you know, we have a tendency to always focus on what we don't have, what we want. Taking some time, you will hear people talk a lot about living in the present, appreciating the present, taking some time to be grateful for what you have. And a lot of that is, you know, understanding the appreciating the mind you have and the opportunity that you have to improve yourself. So if you found any of this interesting, again, a lot of great opportunities right here at this center to learn more. Meditation 101 class, if you haven't taken that, I think that should be starting up soon. I think David McAleese is teaching it. He always does a really good job with that. But that's strictly focused more on meditation, if that's an aspect of this that you're more interested in. It's a really great class. The Discovering Buddhism class, again, it's a series of 14 modules. Each module, like this class, is 5 sessions. So, and it's a repeating 2-year series of these classes. You don't have to start with module 1. You can hop in at any time and start taking those classes. And what each module does is focus on a specific topic in a lot more detail than we went into here. Sunday teachings are great. You know, a lot of, you know, a little more of traditional stuff, like if you haven't been to, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people maybe have already been to the Sunday teachings, but if you haven't, you know, we do some traditional stuff, some prayers and some mantras. But a lot of discussion about different topics. Geshe Gelug will sometimes pick a specific text and discuss and read that text and discuss and explain it and spend, you know, a couple months explaining one specific text. Really, any of the different events and activities that we have here, if any of them appeal to you or are interesting, you know, go for it. There are very few things, and there are a few things where they'll say there are preliminary classes that you need to go through or preliminary steps. This is a more advanced or more specific thing that you need to have gone through these preliminaries first. But most things, even if you just want to sit in the back and watch, that's fine. Like pujas, we talked a little bit about that last week. They were taking down the offerings from a puja. There are more traditional practices and a lot of chanting and meditation and stuff. Sometimes they're done, you know, in Tibetan. If you want to come and just sit in the back and listen, you can do that. But all different ways to learn. Some of the books that are available, two that I, you know, recommend a number of times. One is the How to Meditate, and the other is the Buddhism in a Nutshell. And this, again, you know, you may have heard me say this already, but this includes a lot of several articles and teachings by Lama Zopa Rinpoche and Lama Yeshe and by Venerable Amy Miller. And also as the CD in the back, which is basically parallels these five sessions that we've had, but this is 5 2-hour sessions without all the questions. It's just lecture and meditation. So Venerable Amy goes into, she's a wonderful presenter, and she goes into a lot more detail about some of these topics, introduces some topics or discusses some topics that we really didn't have time to get into. So any interest at all, I'd say this is a good one. Buddhism for Dummies, another one you'll hear people recommend. I never liked those books initially because I didn't like the title. It sounds kind of condescending to me. But again, that's just my own aversion, right? Not anything coming from the side of the book. But if you ever read some of those books, I've read some of them, and other people have read them, and they're actually pretty good. The books themselves are pretty good. So if you get past the title, it's empty of inherent existence, and dig into the book, you know, you might find those interesting. That's it. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. I'll stick around for a few minutes afterwards. I had my email address up earlier in the class, so if you ever, you know, after the class, you're welcome to send me an email anytime, any questions, anything I can help you with. And hopefully you did find some of this interesting, and hopefully you'll stick around. It'd be good to see you all.
Scott, thank you for teaching us.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. So we'll just take a moment to dedicate the merits of being here this evening. Rejoice in your decision to come here and participate. Dedicate any merits that have been accumulated from being here, these however many sessions you attended, to your own benefit and to the benefit of all sentient beings. Just take a moment to think about how wonderful it would be, and just think about the possibility of being yourself through your own efforts to be able to benefit as many beings as possible to the greatest extent possible. Just rest your mind on that thought for just a moment.